It's August, and that means it's time to check your trees to look for signs of an invasive insect that could take out your maples, buckeyes, and more. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. On today's gardening show, we'll hear how to spot these wood-boring beetles. We'll talk about cool season gardening and fall landscaping. And, of course, our experts are here to answer your questions. Joining me now are Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden Manager of Botanical Garden Outreach, Scott Berline. Welcome back, Scott.
Thank you.
Cincinnati Nature Center Director of Conservation, Corey Christopher. Thanks for being here, Corey.
Thanks for having me.
And Ohio State Hamilton County Extension Educator, Joe Boggs. Welcome back, Joe.
Great to be here.
Great to have you all here. If you've got questions for them, and we know you do, give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Joe, let's get started. We're going to talk about these Asian longhorned beetles. Are they still around? How big a threat do they pose?
Well, they could be the most catastrophic non-native invasive to ever arrived at our shores. So, and that's not just an entomologist, you know, drumming up interest. It's the idea that this beetle could possibly take out trees belonging to 12 genera in 9 families. And that would include all maples, as well as you mentioned earlier, buckeyes, poplars. There's an impressive list of trees that we would lose. Some of my colleagues have put it this way, that if Asian longhorn beetle were allowed to go the same route as emerald ash borer, it would make emerald ash borer look like a walk in the park, because that beetle only took, and I say only, yes, we lost all of our ashes, but it only took out trees belonging to one genera, Fraxinus. So we're very concerned about this beetle. And the good news is that it's being slowly eradicated. They're making great progress. And so I need to give kudos to the Ohio Department of Agriculture, working in conjunction with the USDA, and one of the best acronyms I've ever heard, the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, APHIS. It just sounds like APHIS, right?
Yeah.
So they work together on the Asian longhorn beetle eradication program, and they're making fantastic progress. The bad news is that it could still slip through our ports, and so we always have to remain vigilant.
And I mentioned August is the month to check our trees. Why is that, and what should we look for on these trees that these beetles like?
Well, August was chosen because the big beetles, and just let me say, this would be one of the largest beetles you would see in Ohio. They're huge. And before I go too far, I'm about to post, even as we're speaking, an alert, a Buckeye yard and garden line. So if somebody just Googles BYGL, they will soon see an alert that describes everything that I'm going to be talking about. The beetles are huge, and they're black with white spots, very long antennae. That's where the longhorn comes from. So August was selected because this would be the time of year when we'd see the most beetles. The downside, though, is the beetles are actually a little hard to find. Believe it or not, even when we have a heavy infestation, they blend very well with the trees, even though they're huge. It's best to do this. First, let's focus on maples, because that's the number one host for Asian longhorn beetle. And what we want people to look for is something that you'll never see on a healthy maple, and that would be big holes. And I need to stress that. We have a lot of longhorn beetles that are natives that we call the cleanup crew. They come in on trees that are stressed or dying or dead, and they make big holes. But that would be on stress, dying, or dead. A live tree, a tree that looks fantastic and has live branches, leaves are on there, but yet you see these holes about the same diameter as a number two pencil. If you see that on a maple tree, then you would want to contact, and there's information on who you contact. It'd be the Asian Longhorn Beetle Eradication Program. That's what we'd want people to do if they would see that. That's going to be your prime symptom and sign that Asian longhorn beetle is out there.
Are they hard to get rid of?
Well, yes, because they don't really respond to any insecticides to speak of. I mean, we can suppress them with systemics, but we can't guarantee that you will kill everything that's included in the life cycle. And that's important. Eradication means nothing is left of the beetle. Everything is gone from eggs to larvae to pupa to adults. So in terms of getting rid of them, that means that a tree that's infested will be taken down and destroyed. It might seem extreme, but remember what I said earlier. If these are allowed to go the route of emerald ash borer, it would be an ecological catastrophe. Hmm. And so we don't want that. And yes, the program takes time to do, takes a lot of dedicated individuals, but we certainly need the public's help. We need your help to be looking for this beetle and not put it on the back burner, even though we've had a lot of successes. Every infestation in the United States and Canada is either being eradicated successfully or it has been eradicated, but that doesn't mean it might still be somewhere out there undiscovered.
Hmm. Well, we have a link to that blog you mentioned on our website, wvxu.org. So if you want to get the skinny on the Asian longhorn beetle, you can check it out there and get to that blog. Thank you, Joe. We're talking about gardening for the full hour today. Our experts are ready to answer your questions. Give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. Corey, let's talk about some happy landscaping news after hearing about these terrible beetles. What's good to plant this time of year?
So a lot of people see fall. If you're like me, you know, I'm tired of weeding. I'm tired of mowing. And sometimes I just want to put the yard and the garden to bed. But right now is the perfect time to plant any of your shrubs, your trees, a lot of perennials, but especially your native perennials. So if you haven't already, do the walk around your yard, write down, you know, where the areas where you want to supplement what you've got out there already, make your list of what native plants you want to put in. By the end of September, I would say you'll want to start having some of those plants put in. It's easier to plant them now than in spring because you don't have to worry about, you know, suddenly hot weather coming along and having to water them all the time. So even though it is tempting to just throw your hands up and say, I'm done with the yard, it really is the best time to plant a lot of, especially trees and shrubs. Mm-hmm. Now is the time to start planting.
So it's a better time than spring.
It is much better.
Okay.
In terms of the health of the tree, their ability to bounce back from being transplanted. Fall is the time of year to plant. So go out to your nurseries and do that. Again, I would say by the end of September, October, you should still be getting dirty and don't go to rest until about, you know, November or so.
Oh.
In time for Pi Day.
Yeah. Then it's time to hibernate.
Yeah.
So Scott, what are the best plants to get that beautiful fall color that we all look for?
Oh, you know, the maples, especially red maples are outstanding. Nissa or black gums are also called tupelo. Many varieties and even just the straight species always just performs great in the fall. What else? Tulip poplars. I love that yellow. You know, people sometimes will knock yellow and say, oh, that's just a yellow fall color. And I want to wring those people's necks. It's like yellow is a fine color. It's
yes.
Just, you know, just because it's maybe a little common around here doesn't mean it's not great. And some yellows are better than others. That tulip poplar yellow I really like. And I like the fall color on sweet bays. It's a mix of sort of green, brown, and gold, and it's really cool with the texture of the tree. Perennial-wise, you can't beat Amsonia hubrictii or Arkansas Blue Star. It's just a plant everybody should have in their yards, you know, for sunny locations. Doesn't require any care, particularly deer won't bother it. This great texture and form, shrub-like almost all summer, and then this knockout insane gold yellow color in the fall matches with ginkgo as well. If you want to pair it with a tree, they both share the sort of the same color.
What about flower wise? I know a lot of people love mums in the fall.
Yeah, the hardy chrysanthemums. You can buy the annual chrysanthemums and they're great, but just know, you know, no matter how they're advertised, they probably aren't going to come back. These are the ones with the big flowers and the round ball shape and things. there are hardy ones that will come back, and there's more and more of those selections coming on the market. And those are probably among the latest of the flowering plants. So they'll go into well into October, maybe into November, just depending on the year. And that's really important because they're really good pollinator plants. They're supporting those late season pollinators. So that's a good addition. The asters, of course, we like Radon's Favorite at the zoo. We also like October Skies, but there are other ones too. I like those two in particular because deer don't seem to bother them. Mm. And they are just, you know, beautiful blue colors, tons of flowers, great, you know, pollinator plants.
Yeah.
Hey, Scott.
Yeah.
I gotta interject, but particularly with all the work done at Boyer Farm by the zoo, that, you know, goldenrod's nothing to sneeze at, right?
Oh, man. But I'm punched. He's here the whole hour, ladies and germs.
Carlos, remember what we said about muting Joe?
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, goldenrods are really cool plants. Now, there are good goldenrods for gardens, and there are bad ones. The thuggish ones, you don't want. A handful of really nice clumping ones that don't go running amok on you. One that's hardly ever out there, but we've had great success with it at Boyer Farm is Solidago, which is goldenrod, rigida. And I don't even know if it has a common name, but it's a beautiful upright plant with sort of silvery foliage. And it just, it's a great flower. And it's, you know, these are great for the pollinators. We have one also at the zoo we like called Solar Cascade that you can find. And there's one called Fireworks that's pretty common out there. Corey might have some that they sell out at the Nature Center.
Yeah, we sell a variety of goldenrods. Canada's the one that I pull it out of mine. And I was just trying to look up Rigida because is that showy goldenrod?
Showy, yeah.
So showy goldenrod is one of my favorites. And if you're opposed to goldenrod, it might be because you're accustomed to the Canada goldenrod.
Yeah.
But give showy goldenrod, and then there's also zigzag or blue stem goldenrod.
Yes.
Those tend to behave themselves and still give you that, you know, that great pop of color this time of year. So showy's my favorite, though.
Yeah, that's a good one. It really needs to become a common garden plant.
Okay. Well, again, we're talking about gardening for the full hour today. We've got experts here to take your questions. You can call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. We did get an email from William, who writes, "I've noticed what I believe to be a lot more kudzu proliferating on trees in our area. I'm wondering if this is correct, and if so, if it could be related to climate change." What say you, Scott?
Yeah, yes and yes, I think. Definitely yes, it's showing up more. In talking about this prior to the program, I started to question whether it's climate related or not, because some of it has been around a long time and it's been through some cold winters, and I don't know where the line is drawn on what it can live through and what it can't. But it is out there. You know, it's once you've seen it and identified it, you'll recognize it all the time. People from the South will know it immediately. If you see it on your property, you need to work to eradicate it and stay on top of it, because it will eat barns and houses and cars and people.
Now, when you say eat, Corey, I'm going to look at you for this, because I believe you might have brought this with you. Is that what you said when you moved?
I moved up.
The kudzu's your fault?
That was what I heard? That was the joke.
Oh, it was a joke.
About 20 years ago is when people started noticing it.
Okay.
If you see it on your property, you really do have to respond quickly. It will instantly take over within just a couple seasons. So, and it'll take over like power lines. Yeah. And as kids, we call them the kudzu monsters, because it'll wind up looking like this big, I don't know, specter walking down the road. So it's just as nasty as its reputation.
How do you get rid of it?
Well, it's a lot of cutting and removal and probably herbicide treatment for that one. Goats, apparently, we never had goats as a kid, but apparently that will...
Yeah, I've heard of cases where, you know, they've fenced goats in around kudzu and left them there for quite a while, and they'll eat everything, you know. And I think the plant was originally brought here as potential food for livestock.
Oh.
And apparently the goats really like it. I think it's a multi-year issue. You got to exhaust the plant by just denying it leaves and the chance to photosynthesize and feed its roots. Eventually you'll win, but or you won't. You know, maybe you'll die and it'll keep going, you know, or give up or whatever. But that, yeah, at least you have to try.
Yeah. Well, that's a good argument for goats.
You know, though, I during, you know, before we started, I also mentioned, though, that in our area, I consider the kudzu for greater Cincinnati to be porcelain berry. What do you guys think of that?
Yeah, that's another really bad one. It's a vine, again, that just will consume, you know, spare spaces, fence lines, trees, power lines. It's got beautiful berries. Again, once you know it, you'll recognize it. And those berries, of course, feed the birds, and the birds spread it around. So it's not one we're going to – it's one we're going to always deal with. And if you see it in your garden, in your property, in your back fence line, you should do your best to get rid of it. And again, you got to wear it out. You know, herbicides, cuttings, you know, weeding, pulling, you know, cursing, whatever you can do.
And early detection is the key. I mean, just going to going online and getting a list of what are the most common invasives in your area. Porcelain berry is one that we don't have yet at the Nature Center. Fortunately, I probably should not have just said that. But we also, we know what to look for. So when we're out and we see something that catches our eye that's different, we can sort of go through that list of, is this one of the new invasives coming in? So learn them so that when you see them, you can respond quickly to them.
Yeah. Well, we have a caller on the line. Before I pick up Jim's call, I'm going to remind you, you can call us at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Hey, Jim, thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. What's your question or comment?
I had like 5 butterfly bush in my backyard, and then I found out that they're considered evil. So I got rid of 4 of them. I've got 1 left. But my question is, I was told that they're highly invasive, but I've spent a lot of time in nature preserves, parks, trails, like within like a 100-mile radius of Cincinnati, and I have yet to see 1 butterfly bush growing in the wild. So is it really invasive?
That's a good one. There are places where it is a scourge. Pacific Northwest and roadsides along North Carolina, I know for a fact, and in different places. It doesn't seem to be a problem here, but we got to watch it. You know, knowing that it's a problem elsewhere, we've got to keep an eye on it. There are new varieties that are less that are either sterile or produce a lot less seed, so you can feel better about using those. But I think, you know, I'd say we can use it. It's a good garden plant. It's, you know, the pollinators obviously love it, but the responsible thing is to keep a watchful eye out. And if you start seeing problems, you know, act on it. I think Corey's answer is going to be a little different.
No, I would. I mean, I think I tend to be a little more on the side of caution only because of I spend a lot of my time thinking about how to get rid of invasives. In a lot of cases, it's sort of a critical threshold that you reach where an invasive plant may not be invasive in one area, but in another. As you see the number of people planting that particular species, you might reach a point at which it then does become invasive. And we don't really know what that line is for any particular invasive, but we're pretty sure that's what's causing it. It is this threshold, and maybe it's just the crossing of individuals and the cross-pollination that, you know, makes their offspring more likely to survive. What I would ask is what are some of the good native alternatives? I look at the things in my yard, and again, a lot of the goldenrods, Queen of the Prairie is one in my yard that it's a really interesting plant that gets a lot of pollinators. Joe pie weed, which I love. It's one of my favorite plants, gets almost as many. And the other thing we worry about with some of the exotics that bloom a lot, that have, you know, blooms all over the plant, is competition for pollinators. So you may have native shrubs nearby that have beautiful blooms, but the pollinators are attracted to sort of the fast food version of that, to the butterfly bushes. So I try not to guilt people. You know, I don't want to eco shame anybody because I have some exotics in my yard. I would just say, I think you made the right move. You can replace as many as you can with the native, but if you keep one or two, just keep an eye on it. And I don't think it's something to be ashamed of, but I would just look for native alternatives in most of the cases.
It's a really interesting, you know, question and discussion in that, like with butterfly bush, we have many varieties at the zoo. Mm-hmm. We haven't seen any seeding around really. So that critical mass is close, if not already exceeded, and just isn't happening. But what we did find is with Lespediza, when we had one variety, beautiful plant, great fall plant, no issue with seeding around. But then when we got other varieties and they started crossing, suddenly now we're seeing a problem. So we got rid of all the Lespediza. You know, each species is different, and is, you know, there's no easy, complete answer all the time, but it's, you just have to be responsible and thoughtful and do what you feel is right.
And that is what happened with the calorie pear, the Bradford pear, where you had suddenly all these different cultivars that were introduced, and the cultivars started cross-pollinating, and those offspring are the ones that become invasive. So it's something to look out for. I think the zoo does a pretty good job at keeping an eye on, on potential invasives. So
there's a really cool network now with many of the botanical and public gardens, arboretums, mm-hmm. where they're cross referencing their problem plants. They're sharing that information, and it's in the early stages, but it's real eye opening, and it could lead to some very good policy recommendations.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jim, thanks so much for that question. We are going to, I think we lost the person I was going to take. Okay, we are going to have to take a quick break. We have some folks on hold, but we need to take a quick break. We'll be back with more of our gardening show. If you have questions, give us a call, 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back with our gardening show and a crop of experts to answer your questions. My guests are Cincinnati Nature Center Director of Conservation, Corey Christopher, Ohio State Hamilton County Extension Educator, Joe Boggs, and Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden Manager of Botanical Garden Outreach, Scott Birdline. They're ready for your gardening questions, so give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. We have a couple callers on the line. Let's go to Mary. Hi, Mary. Thanks so much for your call. What's your question?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question about slug control. I planted some large dahlia bulbs in my garden this year, along with coneflowers and various other things, and the slugs just decimated them. I tried, you know, the regular slug go in the beer things. I tried diatomaceous earth. I tried even picking them off, but I could not get ahead of them. So I wondered what else I could do.
Any thoughts? We're getting some stump. Go ahead, Joe.
Use the beer in a different way. Is that what I'm going to hear, Scott? Is that what?
Just drown your sorrows.
Yeah, you did that too. Mary, I am very surprised because you've, we always talk about the beer traps because, mm-hmm. you know, research has clearly demonstrated both beer that has the alcohol in it and the non-alcoholic beers that they are highly effective. Now, let me just ask a quick question. You sunk the pie pans, for example, to be level with the earth and so that they can just crawl right in. Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, we have a lot of large pine nugget mulch over this whole area. So I sunk it to the level below the level of the mulch.
Okay. Well, one thing that we have to say, and of course, the other point is if you use slug baits, you know, that's like the next step. If the beer doesn't work, the beer traps, then, you know, the baits. But if those are all failing, and this year, you know, this it's a blessing and a curse that we've had unlike last year, when we were suffering, you know, a record-breaking drought, you know, this year we're getting spots of rain, so things are remaining a little bit more moist, and that's what slugs and snails and, you know, other critters of that group love. You may want to do something that you got to be a little careful with and not let the soil dry out. You may want to pull away the mulch and try to start creating an environment where it's much drier. Now, those slugs will love to be in this moist area with mulch. So you may want to try that. Have you already done that? Or
I did try that some, but I mean, you're right. It kept raining and raining and raining. So it was hard to get it to dry out. One of my things I'm curious about is they did not go after the other plants that were right next to them.
They can be highly selective. And, we saw this with hostas, which, you know, some people call slug bait, right? But it's not true with hostas. Yeah. Some hostas, there's a lot of variability, but just rake away, you know, the mulch. Those big chunks will really help to create a great atmosphere. Try to get it down to where you can dry the soil, where the soil is dried off. And I think you'll have success with that. You may want to combine that with redistributing the beer traps, you know, so now you're down the soil. Yeah.
Yes.
And if all else fails, my original recommendation, we go back to that, right?
Yes. Sounds great. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Mary. We appreciate your call. Let's see. One of our callers who had to hang up after holding for a while was Holly. Holly had a problem with ants in her tree. She's wondering what she should do, who she should call. Joe, do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, those are probably most likely, if they're big ants or carpenter ants, and they're part of our forest ecology. I mean, Corey could really answer this at Cincinnati Nature Center because of the very large number of forested areas. Carpenter ants do not bore into trees alone. The trees have to be getting decayed on the inside. The carpenter ants use the fungal decayed wood softening to create their tunnels. They don't eat wood. They just tunnel the wood. So there's a symbiotic relationship between the interior decay and the carpenter ants. So the first thing you might want to consider is if you have a tree with carpenter ants, you may want to have a certified arborist and a very specific type of arborist, one that is track qualified. If that tree represents any type of perceived hazard, the carpenter ants could tell us it needs to be assessed by a tree risk assessment qualified arborist. And that's going a little bit perhaps too far. But first, we don't want you to get rid of those carpenter ants because they create satellite nests. You might have four or five nests in an area with only one queen. And if you get rid of the nest with the queen, then these other nests will start producing queens. That's just how they survive, again, as part of forest ecology. That, though, increases the risk with all these extra queens for the ants to start appearing in structures. And so the best thing to do is just simply recognize what's there, that this is just part of having trees. Second is that you need to consider that if you have carpenter ants, those trees could be hollow inside, and then have them assessed by an arborist if you believe the tree represents a risk.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. I'm sure Holly will appreciate that information. We now have Kathy on the line. Hi, Kathy. Thanks for calling. What's your question today?
Hi. I have a boggy corner of the garden that just keeps on getting overrun, I think, by annual burn weeds that I think are native. And so there's just a part of me that wonders if I could let it go every year with those burn weeds.
What do you think, Corey?
Yeah, if it's burn weed or fireweed, you absolutely could just let it go. I mean, I think it's a beautiful plant. If you choose to do that, I would not ignore it completely. You know, at least every couple weeks, take a little walk in the area. There are a lot of invasives that will come in when you start sort of benign neglect. It's a great land management strategy sometimes. So if you're just neglecting that area by not cutting it, if you've got that fireweed, burnweed, that's great. Just keep an eye on it that you don't see like your calorie pear or your honeysuckle or any of those come in because that could be a bigger problem. So I would say keep it, but just keep an eye on it.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Kathy. And we now have Alyssa on the line. Hi, Alyssa.
Hi. I have a question about spotted lanternfly. We have several trees of heaven. They're fine. They're healthy. And I've been reading lately that there's predators of spotted lanternfly. Do we need to take these trees down or can they stay?
Scott, do you want to take a stab at this?
I mean, they're going to, if they don't have the fly right now, they will get it. And it will, you know, you can treat, it's kind of a weed tree. It's not the greatest tree that people want. It's pretty invasive. It's just going to continue to attract the lanternfly. I would say you probably want to move, you know, have a strategy of eventually doing that. Maybe right away, maybe you wait while you plant some other things and get some other trees going. But yeah, long-term strategy is that those trees aren't going to be there and you want to do something.
And I will add, don't try to do it yourself because the sap can be particularly toxic and cause all kinds of issues. So get a tree company to come out and do that particular work for, even if they're smaller trees, get a tree company to come out.
Oh, they're big.
So definitely.
They're big. And we have a quote. It's expensive.
It is.
Just for the sake of the environment, not just, there's not enough predators for spotted lantern to mitigate, you know, and make this possible.
Joe can answer this better. They do kind of collapse in numbers, but.
Yeah. That over time, spotted lantern fly will move to the background, just like Japanese beetles have and so on. But,
yeah.
You know, here's another option. And this is because we're getting questions, well, if I take down, you know, Tree of Heaven, will that eliminate the spotted lanternfly? Well, no, there's plenty of Tree of Heaven out there. It is the number one host, but the second most important host for spotted lanternflies are maples. And that's something that we tend to forget about in terms of trees. But if you were a large landscape area like a cemetery or an area where you have a lot of landscaping, there's another option that's being used, and that's actually using the Tree of Heaven as so-called trap trees. Now, I don't think I would recommend that you do this because it would, again, be very expensive, and you know, you're kind of helping out the neighborhood, but it's not going to, over the long haul, suppress spotted lanternfly in greater Cincinnati. But what's being done and what's been done is actually to treat those trees with a systemic. And for those taking notes, the active ingredient is dinateferon, which is also called safari. And that then makes the tree specifically toxic to spotted lanternfly. And you're not really wrecking the environment because you're not spraying the whole tree. It's systemic. It's inside the tree. And so that does suppress spotted lanternfly in that immediate vicinity because they'll go to that tree first and they will die. So I just wanted to let people know that, you know, that you could be hearing about that option in our region. But for your particular situation, I don't believe I would go that route. I think that's a little bit too far. But taking those trees down also over the long haul really won't make a huge difference in our dealing with spotted lanternfly for a while.
Okay. Well, I hope that helps, Alyssa. Thank you for calling. We're going to go to some other callers. We have Mona on the line. Hi, Mona.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing all right. What's your question for our experts?
I have a weeping cherry tree that is an anomaly. First of all, it's probably 12 feet high, which is very unusual for a weeping cherry. And then the other thing is that it drops leaves most of the summer. And it starts maybe in mid-June. And then by, you know, this time of the year, they're just falling. It looks like it's October. And I'm wondering what might cause that.
Hmm.
Joe.
You want me to handle that? Because yeah. we're dealing with that, right? Yeah. yeah. It's cherry leaf spot. It's fungal disease. Sometimes people call it cherry hole spot. It actually is a necrotic area. Those little spots drop out. They create holes, makes it look like something's eaten the leaves. But you've described it perfectly. Environmental conditions this year have been very, very conducive to infections in the spring. The best thing to do is the fungus overwinters in the fallen leaves. So just keep raking up and getting rid of the fallen leaves. And you can actually, you can break the disease cycle if you just keep doing that. The worst thing we can do is just let those leaves decompose under the tree, because that represents a lot of inoculum that can reinfect the tree next spring.
Well, Mona, okay. I sure hope that helps. Thanks so much for calling. Rich, I know you're on the line. Please hang on. We have to take another quick break, and we will be back to answer your question and wrap up today's gardening show. Again, the number to call is 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back to wrap up today's gardening show. My guests are Ohio State Hamilton County Extension educator Joe Boggs, Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden Manager of Botanical Garden Outreach Scott Berline, and Cincinnati Nature Center Director of Conservation Corey Christopher. If you've been waiting to ask your questions, wait no more. We are entering the lightning round of our show. The number to call is 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. I'm going to go to Rich. Rich, thank you so much for your patience. What's your question?
Well, actually, thanks to a previous...
Whoop, did we just lose Rich? I think he was going to say thanks to a previous caller. Maybe Rich got his answer question or his question answered inadvertently. I'm going to put you on hold, Rich, and we'll see if we can get you back at some point. We have Connie on the line. Hi, Connie. Thanks for calling. What's your question? Do I have you, Connie? Well, my phone system's fighting with me right now, so let's go to some emails. We do have some emails that are backed up. We got an email from David who writes, I have been successfully growing vincas in my garden for decades. For the second summer in a row, they've been afflicted by wilting leaves. They're in a sunny location that receives a lot of full sun from mid-morning until early evening. The leaves begin to fold downward on the edges. Seems like one plant is affected, and the wilting proceeds to hit one plant after another in a sequence over a couple of weeks. There's roughly 12 inches between each plant. You have any thoughts on that, Scott?
My only thought, and this is just a kind of a guess, but the amount of rain we've had, vinca likes it pretty dry, and maybe it's just suffering root rots just because it cannot get the drainage it needs.
Okay. Well, hope that helps, David. Let's see if we can get back to our callers. Hi, Rich. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. Were you did we magically answer your question already?
No.
Okay.
I was going hello, and you were saying I can't hear you.
Sorry about that.
Anyway, I said thanks to a previous caller. I actually have two questions. The one I called about was I live up in Urbana, north of Springfield. We've got an apple tree that has yellowing. Drying out leaves, yellow leaves with spots. The app for plants, the picture of this app says, this looks healthy. My wife is pretty sure we got a fungus.
I'm sorry. Did I write that app? I mean, that may have been one of mine, right? I said, oh, yeah. I think, would you guys all agree it sounds like apple scab?
Yeah. Basically an identifiable feature for apples, in my opinion.
Mm. Yeah. It's and fruit trees as well as crab apples. Now, if you have really distinct reddish spots, that would be frog eye leaf spot. That's another. Both are fungal diseases. They're both related to how susceptible the trees are. But once again, you know, we have this idea that if you get rid of the leaves that fall, it won't guarantee that next year the tree is going to be, you know, free of disease, but it actually will help a great deal in reducing. Well, again, I used this a while ago, inoculum. That's just what we call something that inoculates a tree with a disease-causing organism.
Okay. And Rich, do you have another question real quick?
I do. Last year before, I cut down a tree of hell. It keeps coming, and it keeps trying to resurrect. It sprouts up all over the yard, coming up to my porch.
I was going to mention that earlier. When you cut down a tree of heaven, you get years and years of sprouts. You will wear it out if you just string trim them down, cut them down. You can hit them with herbicide. That'll knock them down, but they'll come back. You just have to wear it out.
Okay. Well, good luck, Rich, and thanks for your patience with my technical problem that I was having. I'm sure I caused it. Hey, Connie, thanks so much for your call. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Oh, wonderful. What's your question?
I have a large garden area on the side of my house with some daylilies and some ground cover, and the ground cover has just taken over. It's a succulent, and I'd like to get rid of it. And I'm also having violets that just keep popping up and are now taking over that area as well. And I wanted to know what's the best way to get rid of that.
Do you have thoughts, Corey?
I do. A couple of questions. The succulent, do you know what kind it is, the ground cover?
I do not. It's got little tiny, like it. If I put it in a hanging pot, it trails downward with little tiny pointed leaves.
Like rice-sized kind of leaf, well, bigger than rice, but looks kind of like that shape.
Yeah, kind of.
Sort of probably not, a sedum.
Yeah, I was thinking some sort of sedum. What I will say is, I think a lot of us fight violets because they do so well in our area, but they do make a good ground cover if you let them go. A lot of people just don't like the look of them, so I would be less worried about the violets. I don't know if you have any suggestions for sedum.
Just pulls really easy. It just stay on it. It's not like one of these problem plants where you have to go years and years and years. If you pull it and pull it again and maybe a third time, you're really starting to get a handle on it. So I would just do the pulling route. If you do want to get rid of the violets, get a little hand hoe and you kind of get under the plant and lift out that little rhizome. And that helps you wear it out fast. But, I've never let that go as a ground cover. That's an intriguing thought.
I've moved it around to various beds, and it'll take a couple seasons, but it'll do pretty good. I mean, it's, highly seasonal. So.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Connie. I sure hope that helps. We do have some other emails. Barbara emailed, "I'm trying to grow perennials, but rabbits have eaten my lavender and yarrow. Thus far, they've left the bee balm alone. Coneflowers and butterfly weed have been attacked but survive. Allium remain untouched. Suggestions?"
More allium. rabbits have been, for the last few years, been a real problem for me and a lot of other gardeners. I don't know what it is that's favoring rabbits right now. Sprays, physically chasing them off, I think actually kind of works. A dog in the yard. Those are the main things, but... the plants that they don't like are pretty good.
The pellets and sprays do work,
Yeah.
Go to a reputable establishment to purchase them, but they do actually work.
Okay. We also got an email from Claire. Now, we showed this picture to you, Corey, and Scott in the studio. For the picture was there was a picture that came with this email, and Claire asks, "Can you suggest what suddenly caused the middle section of what I think is a purple willow to die?"
So the picture, just to describe it real quick, was a very healthy plant with a big blotch of dead in the middle of it. My first thought was it looked like maybe an exhaust pipe was lined up to it and just kind of burned it. That happens in parking lots a lot. This was at the end of a driveway. It's a little higher than you normally think of for an exhaust issue. So it could also have been just a physical issue where, something fell on it and broke off that section of branches or damaged that section of branches. Willows don't typically get a lot of things that like take out areas of them. Joe may be aware of more of that than I am, but.
Anything you want to add, Joe?
Okay, so I can't see it. Is this Purpurea, Salix purpurea,
yeah,
Scott?
Yeah,
Nana. Okay, yeah, okay. Well, one thing they can get are some cankering diseases that will take out sections. So you'd want to make sure, if that's a possibility, just take a look at what's dying back. And this applies to a lot of different trees, small trees. if you see an area that's sunken, the bark's sunken, it's dying out, try to cut below and get rid of that. Unfortunately, it may progress back into the main area, and then you're really in real trouble. But it's not uncommon. Just have a little small section, and if you take it out, the cankering can be managed.
Okay. Well, I have a question from Steve. Steve's on the line, but we're running out of time, so I'm going to ask his question real quick. He's wondering why his Spring Grove dogwood is wilting. The top leaves are wilting. The bottom leaves are fine. Is there anything he can do?
I think that might be a Joe question. Yeah.
Joe. Oh, Joe. Okay. Yeah.
So this year, we've seen an unprecedented amount of Septoria leaf spot on dogwoods. And you mentioned Spring Grove because I actually took a lot of pictures of the Spring Grove dogwood. It's unprecedented. It probably won't happen again, but you've described it perfectly. Those very small spots coalesce until we start seeing wilting. There's really nothing we can do about it. It will probably not really hurt the overall health of the tree, and that's important. Because the tree had plenty of time to, you know, acquire carbohydrate from the functional leaves. But right now, they're really starting to look bad. If we were in a drought, we'd think it was a drought. That's what it kind of looks like, the wilting and so on. But it's just I consider it an anomaly this year, but I wouldn't write the trees off at all.
Okay. Well, Steve, I hope that helps. We're almost out of time, but Scott, the zoo has a couple symposiums coming up. I know you wanted to tell us briefly about those.
Yeah, we have about 30 seats left for the one coming up August 28th. So that's just a couple weeks from now. Really good program with 7 nice sessions. I won't go into details. I know we're short of time. It's going to be a good day for gardeners, green industry people to come have a good informational, inspirational day.
Okay. And Corey, you said there's a garden tour you want to talk about. You got about 30 seconds.
Yes. If you have a neighbor or if your own yard is to the state that you want to show it off to the rest of the region and you want to be a part of our garden tour, reach out to gardentour@cincynature.org. It is our notable natives garden tour. Doesn't have to be all natives. And our fall plant sale starts September 20th, 10 to 5 daily at Real Woods.
Okay. We'll get some of this information on our website. Both these links will be on our website at wvxu.org. Another fantastic gardening show.
it ends too quickly.
It does. It's too much fun. Well, I've been talking with Cincinnati Nature Center Director of Conservation, Corey Christopher, Ohio State Hamilton County Extension Educator, Joe Boggs, and Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden Manager of Botanical Garden Outreach, Scott Berline. Thank you all so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks a lot. You take care.
You too. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Celine Reader. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez Cornu. And if you miss our program live, shame on you. But you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.